I know he's at first. You've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value. I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore. I want you to get up right now. Get up, go to your windows, open them, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Listen, you fuckers, you screwheads. Here is a man who would not take it anymore. A man who stood up against the scum, the cunts, the dogs, the filth, the shit. Here is someone who stood up.
Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to another edition of U of Trotomy Radio. Today is April the 3rd, 2011. And tonight we're going to have on Amelia Foxwell and White Owl from the White Oaks chart, or the White Oaks chapter of CECOM, Southeast Constitutional Militia. We're going to be talking about a couple different things tonight with them. We're going to be talking about, for a little bit about the Duncan, Oklahoma gathering they just came from, a little meet and greet face to face they had up there with a few other people, as well as an MTV documentary that Amelia has been part of. We're not going to spend too much time on that though, because They were on Fox's show a couple Saturdays ago, I believe. Two Saturdays ago, in fact. And they spent a lot of time discussing that. So we're just going to touch on that briefly. What I really wanted to discuss with them, though, was the CECOM, Southeast Constitutional Militia. It's supposedly an organization who is going to, whose agenda it is to start getting the militia of the local regional areas working on standard operating procedures, communications, tactics, training, things like that. So we're waiting for them to call in. I just spoke with them a few minutes ago, and we'll be talking with them here as soon as they call in. Are they on yet, by any chance, Dave?
Not yet. I'm still waiting.
No? Here, I tell you what, why don't you take over real quick, Dave? Run your mouth or something? I don't know, man. Say some stuff and I'll get them a call and get them to call in again.
Okay, well, we're off doing that. It's definitely good to be here. They were, in fact, on the Armory with Fox a couple weeks ago. It was definitely an interesting show. We're going to be working on getting the archives page up and running and some changes to the website here in the next week. And it looks like we've got somebody from 941, so I'm going to go ahead and put them on the air here, and I'll see if that's the magic call we're waiting for.
Hey, Amelia, Randy, phone number.
It is the magic call. This is Amelia and White Owl.
Hey, Amelia. Hey, White Owl. How are you guys doing?
I'm sorry?
How are you guys doing? This is Randy.
We're doing very well.
Very good. Thank you.
All right, well, you know, since you guys are on, I basically just told everybody we're going to be talking for the first little bit. I wanted to talk to you guys about the Duncan get-together face-to-face that you had, as well as, a little bit about the MTV thing. But like I mentioned to you before, as well as, you know, the listeners right now, you guys have covered a lot of that already with the previous interview you did with Fox a couple of weeks ago on the show. So
right.
I don't want to go into that too much. You know, what I was really wanted to go into was the Southeast Constitutional Militia, CECOM. So, welcome to the show. Thank you guys for coming on.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much for having us on.
Oh, not a problem. You know, I've been, I had mentioned to you before, you know, I haven't been able to get back with you yet. I tried calling once when I got voicemail, or your voicemail was full, so I couldn't leave a message. But my father-in-law came into town, so I've just been slammed the last week. So, you know, I haven't really been able to get back with anybody this week at all. But I really was interested in talking with you. I like some of the things that you were saying. A lot of your ideas that I saw on well-regulated American militias, you know, I thought they were right on line. I thought, you know, you were going off in a, you know, as far as some of the ideas that you had or some of your views. you know, your observations in life were dead on. So I've been wanting to talk to you for a little bit, in fact.
Well, thank you very much for that, and hopefully we'll have a little bit of an opportunity to do that this evening.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it. So, you know, let's start off with that then. Let's talk about this MTV and Duncan, Oklahoma thing. You guys just recently are fresh back from Oklahoma. How was the trip?
The trip was wonderful. We kind of didn't know what to expect. And we had originally set it up as kind of a local leadership meeting, and then because of a lot of the things that Charles Dyer is going through with his court case coming up, we really needed to make it kind of a more low-key event. And I have had MTV following me for a couple months now at a few different functions, and I mentioned to them that I was going, and they wanted to come. I actually talked to the producer about him. She did a lot of research on him. She did research on his case, and she was really interested to be able to get some footage of that. And basically, they recorded him arriving at our campsite. They recorded an interview that I did with him for an article that should be coming out Tuesday in Human Events and Guns and Patriots. And they recorded a little bit about his court case and about me asking him if he would be on board with some of the projects that we're doing and if he would be supportive of them. So all in all, it really was a wonderful meet, and it was great to get to meet his parents. And, you know, you can see a lot of things and read a lot of different things. And when you get to stand face-to-face with someone, all of the details take on a whole new meaning. And I'm really glad I got to do that.
You know, that's interesting that you know, when I first heard about the MTV thing, I was, as always, leery. This is my background. This is where I come from. You know, I was in that culture creation industry, and I was really good at what I did. And I understand the purpose of our mainstream media, especially organizations like MTV itself. Now, from what you had told me before, this person is not actually employed by MTV. They're an independent production company, and they're just being and they're basically producing this for MTV to air. Now, when I read that, I got kind of interested. So I wanted to, when I started noticing that, and I realized that MTV had actually been running a couple of commercials recently showing a very police state environment.
Absolutely. They are it's funny because I found those commercials because in one of Charles Dyer's most recent videos, a screen flashes on that says, "The Holocaust happened to people like us." And I wanted to know where that segment from, and I Googled it, and it came from MTV. It came from an MTV. It was not originally produced by MTV, but they did air it, and they put it on Think MTV, which is one of their website subsidiaries. And it's actually very interesting because when I was doing all the research trying to figure out whether or not, you know, this is a horrible mistake or not, I found Think MTV, and it's a social network for young people who want to be active. And they have groups on there about constitutional issues. And it was very interesting, a lot of the things that I found when I started doing research. And when this producer first contacted me, I asked her, I said, you know, why are you guys doing this show? And she said, well, the basic deal is that MTV wants to appeal to as many people as possible, and they've recently come to understand that there are a lot of young people who are very concerned about their government. And, you know, she said, regardless of their internal politics, they are a business, and they do want to appeal to as much of their target audience as possible.
Well, that statement is very true. I mean, you know, when you look at the entire marketing, you know, the whole marketing, consumerist, you know, TV industry, the bottom line is it's run by dollars and cents. And they will promote what they will begin to show ideas that their target audience is into. And that's the bottom line. You know, good, bad, or indifferent, it doesn't matter. It's just the reality and the way things are. For instance, we have Glenn Beck all of a sudden. You know, we've got, you know, Glenn Beck is on Fox, and, you know, that's mainstream media to the hilt. I mean, it's controlled. It's owned by GE. In fact, Fox News was, you know, took some of their reporters, you know, was dragged to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court stood behind their stance that they are not required to tell the truth. This was Fox. So, you know, they give us what they want us to hear, and they will, you know, if they find a movement arising, they will begin to step into that area and hope, you know, many of them, like Fox, will engage in, you know, manufactured dissent or controlling the dissent, leading the dissent, guiding it, taking it where they feel it should go. You know, so it's always a business. You know, it's about numbers and dollars. It's about dollars and cents, again, as always. But, you know, you were saying that you felt very comfortable with this person, though, the lady that had done it. And also, I found something interesting, that she had been given full editing rights as well as rights to the material, and that she was willing to give over that raw footage to you as well.
Yes, she actually said that, because we asked her if we could have, she shot an FTX of ours, and we asked her if we could have the footage for training purposes for our website. She said absolutely. There is a legal issue with some of the places that she went. Like she went to my school and they signed a disclosure or a release. And like she went to my yoga studio and they signed a release. And those releases were given directly to MTV. So she has to kind of figure out if it's legally okay for her to give us that footage. But the footage of our FTX, which she filmed on our property, she's going to give us because there's no legal issue with that.
Well, it works. If I may answer that, at the end of the FTX, when she had each of our members sign the release, there was also a clause added at the time, because of my concern, that the footage that was shot would be for the sole purpose of MTV's True Life series. That way it can't be released or purchased by any other media outlets, because we felt comfortable with their editing, but if the raw footage was turned over to, say, MSNBC or CNN, they would be able to do with that footage anything they like, and we didn't want them having access.
Yes, they could wreak havoc. We know that. We've watched every other documentary or media spot or newscast that's ever been done about Militia. So, yeah, that's always a concern. But, you know, we get it.
Yeah, but Amelia said something to me that really made the most sense because I don't mind telling you, we had a few heated debates about whether this should ever occur. And finally, the chip she played that really convinced me was, with all the negative stigma and media attention that there has been on Militia out there, what is another 5 minutes of bad press really going to do to us that hasn't already been done?
That's my point. You know, I mean, you know, the way I look at it, I really don't care. I come from a PR industry. That's what I did. I'm PR and marketing. I got people to buy stuff that they normally would not have bought. Very expensive stuff, too. And, you know, I took a Japanese company, I made them number one in the country in under 2 years. Go figure. So the people, you know, so I've always been of the opinion that even bad media is good media. I don't care. You can take any media out there and you can make something good of it.
Well, I've never been in show business, but I have heard them say that even bad press is a good thing. So the truth of it is, you know, the mainstream America might always fear anyone that's not a police officer that has anything to do with firearms whatsoever. I've discovered that the people that are afraid of firearms literally know nothing about them. And you know, we tend to fear what we don't understand. People believe that firearms or weapons of any kind are absolutely tools to commit murder. And that's, you know, as you well know, that's certainly not what we're about. And I wish I could remember the commander's name. This was very interesting. A military commander had a group of Boy Scouts that he had his men train at the firing range.
Okay.
And at the end of the training, he was interviewed by a somewhat liberal media personality who said, Commander, don't you believe that you are equipping these boys for murder? And I believe his response was, Madam, you're equipped to be a prostitute. That doesn't mean you are.
You know, I I'm always amazed by the fact that the people out there are so easily swayed in their opinions. You know, when something that is 100% constitutional was the very foundation of this country and the reason that we even have a country, one of the two reasons, and now we consider that a bad thing is just amazing.
Well, firearms of all types are for many different purposes, from sporting to competition. Defense is obviously in there as well. And none of that is, I mean, the Second Amendment does not delineate between the different types of firearms. It doesn't say that you can only have sporting firearms, and we're all aware of this. So people, when a firearm is used in the commission of a crime, and the media covers that over and over and over, I mean, still rarely in the newspaper do I see where homeowners have defended themselves legally with a firearm. The only place I find that is in my NRA magazines. You know, we preach to the choir constantly about that. But, you know, many other things besides firearms are used for the commission of crime, but we don't attack those items because the people, when a vehicle is used to run them, when a husband or a wife is upset with the other and they use the vehicle to run them down and murder them, illegally kill them, we don't, you know, they don't go after cars because they understand cars. They know what they're about. They drive a car. But when they don't own firearms, don't know anything about them, and they hear about a firearm crime, then it, in their mind, it often is can only be used for negative or nefarious purposes.
Agreed. You know, and that's an image that is presented out there by that same media. You know, if you look back to the 80s, every news broadcast, it doesn't matter where you lived. You could live in Ohio, and you were hearing about all of the gun crime in South Central L.A., all the gun crime in Chicago, all the gun crime in New York, Florida, places, you know, wherever there was heavy gun crime, you would hear about it. Even if it had nothing to do with your area, it was presented to you as this is global, this is all over your country, this is everywhere, it's in your backyard. And a lot of places in the country weren't facing anything like that at all. So, you know, again, we demonize stuff. I mean, we have commercials now, you know, saying if you see people with guns, you know, if you're concerned, call. You know, I got Walmart. You know.
If I can, just to keep you apprised of the situation, if you have specific questions for Amelia, she has about 15 minutes before she has another call.
Okay, no problem. Actually, yeah, if you wouldn't mind, let me get back to Amelia really quick because I, you know, I really wanted to talk to her and how she got involved with that. So, Amelia, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, Amelia, you know what? I actually wanted to get into a little bit about you. In fact, you know, you are not the prototypical militia person that the news likes to portray out there. And I'd like to get into a little bit about you and who you are and your background and how you got involved. Would you mind telling us a little bit about yourself?
Certainly. I'm a student. I have been a psychology student. I'm a senior. And in the last year, I've decided to switch back to go to law school instead of going to pursue my master's in psychology. And that's mainly because of all the things that I've seen around me. I want to go into constitutional law, and I feel like it's a very necessary and very needed thing. My background is not typical militia either. Most of my parents were missionaries, and actually most of my family were missionaries for the deaf in inner city Baltimore. I grew up in kind of a ghetto area and trying to school people who were really underadvantaged, and most of them were mentally handicapped. Most of them had been taken out of asylums because of what we used to do with deaf people. And I got a very clear image very young that our society is everyone's, and that there are political factors that impact everyone's daily life. When my parents left Baltimore, they left for political reasons. And very early on, I had the experience to learn that politics is nothing to do with what is best for people. It has nothing to do with what the people want. It has to do with money and power. So I absolutely never considered myself political, and I was never politically involved. I got involved with the militia movement because I was looking for people of integrity and action, and I was looking for like-minded people who were doing something. I got involved with the militia movement. I got frustrated with the militia movement. I remember very clearly I had an aha moment on a Sunday afternoon after an FCS, and I was 30 and I was beat up and I was tired and I was disgusted. And I looked at Lisa and I said, what are we doing? You know, we're not doing anything here. We're prepared.
I'm sorry, you're starting to break up. You're starting to break up. Are you on a cell phone or a cordless?
I am on a cell phone, okay. But I believe I have good reception. Where did you lose me?
You're good right now. You're good right now.
Okay, I won't move.
Don't move.
did you get all of that, or did you lose me?
No, we got most of it, I think. You know, so, you know, I wanted to bring that about. You know, you are that typical girl next door, suburban, you know, suburban middle, you know, middle class family. You know, you're, yeah. You didn't come from some southern, you know, Confederate flag waving family. You didn't come from some heartland of America, you know, conspiracy theorist family. You came from that typical Main Street America family.
Yes, I family full of Methodist ministers. We had one gun in our house. It was a .22 rifle that no one really knew how to shoot. My grandfather took me shooting when I was little with a BB gun, and I hadn't owned a gun until about 3 years ago. You know, nobody in my family has a membership to the NRA. I consider myself more of a humanitarian, and I believe that our government is violating humanitarian basics. And, you know, I don't consider myself political or, you know, I mean, I'm Southern, but Maryland is only kind of Southern. So I spent a long time, I think I was 12 before I realized that I lived south of the Mason-Dixon. You know, I didn't grow up in the kind of environment that most people who are in militias do, but I came to the same realization and the same train of thought and the same belief system that everyone that I train with and everyone that I interact with has because of the life experiences that I had.
Now, when you first went out and you started looking at the concept and you started looking or started investigating militia, what was your purpose? What was your intent?
My intent was that I was looking for people who were doing something. And I had, I don't know how I had this, but I had kind of the antithesis of the media's interpretation of militia. I thought that all militia were ex-military, kind of oath keeper, you know, like devoted for the rest of your life to upholding, you know, I thought they were all super warriors. And I really had kind of a glorified image of the militia, but what I was seeking was I was seeking strong individuals of integrity who were doing something. And that was, you know, I had been involved with a lot of different groups, like Restore America type things and 9/12 projects. And, you know, I sat in all these warehouses and listened to people talk for hours about things like fluoride and the Bilderbergs. And I just got distracted. And I just wanted to find people who were actually doing something. So that was why I looked up a militia, because I had some idea in my head that they were people of action that I would find there.
No, that's a good thing. So when you first started looking at the militia, what was your initial reaction, or your response, your ideas? What was your impression?
Well, my initial response was I posted a message on the USM webpage for Florida, and I said, I'm in Florida, and I'm looking for a group. And I was immediately contacted by someone who referred me to someone in my area, and I met with two of the gentlemen for lunch, and they were very interesting, and they were very nice. And, you know, they were very shocked that I was interested. And then I went to a day training, and I remember having a very surreal moment where I was standing on a sugar sand range with nine guys in camo and assault rifles, and I thought, how did I get here? and then it was like from that moment on, those people became my best friends, and those people became the people that I talked to every day, and the people that I was the closest to, and the people that came to dinner at my house all of the time, and the people that I called, you know, to talk about every idea that I ever had. You know, my militia very quickly became my family, and through that, I've actually gained a greater appreciation for large patriot groups as well, and the camaraderie that they have.
Mm-hmm. So, what did you think the first time you went out, you got suited up in camo, you went out there, you got a gun in your hand, you got a pack, you're surrounded by a bunch of guys out in the middle of nowhere. What was going through your head?
Oh dear. it was just one of those where you don't think you're scared, you don't think you're whatever, you just are standing there thinking, wow, I'm really doing this, and this is kind of bizarre. You know, I've had a lot of people who have known me for a very long time that when I said I joined a militia, they all kind of looked at me with like this really confused look, and I know how they feel because that's how I felt at that moment. I thought, wow, this is very interesting, and I wonder how this is all going to work out. Whitehall was actually there that day. And he looked at me at one point, and he said, "You look like you're trying to figure out how you got here." I said, "Yeah, pretty much." But it's interesting because when you get to know people and you form relationships with them, it makes the whole thing instantly comfortable and instantly something that you feel immersed in, and that's also, I think, has been my greatest success with explaining the militia to other people, because I explain it on a human level. I tell them what it means to me. I tell them what I do. I tell them, you know, what my vision is. And I think that once you realize that a militia is a group, is a family group, really, that it all becomes more human and more safe to you.
Well, I agree with you. You know, we tend to fear the unknown. We tend to fear the things that we don't understand, the things that we don't educate ourselves on, and the things that we haven't read up on, you know, or the things that we only get partial stories about, and those partial stories are geared to making us fear the unknown.
Right.
So, you know, my compliments and my kudos to you for going out there and actually looking and then having the courage to engage. I mean, like I said, you are not, you know, you would not be what the mainstream media would classify as your typical, you know, hillbilly or redneck with an AK-47 or conspiracy theorist or, you know, nutcase survivalist, you know, end of the worlder. You're a psychology student who's trying to become a lawyer.
Well, I think that's been my biggest asset in explaining the militia to people, is because when people look at me and I say I'm in a militia, they think, oh, wow, I must not really understand what they are. You know, the news people must not be right. You know, I think this has helped a lot.
Well, I agree with you, and I want to thank you for that aspect as well. Overall, with the, you know, the Duncan get together and the MTV thing, what was your overall impression? Did you guys, was it successful? Did you guys achieve what you wanted to achieve there? Did you guys actually come away from there with a good feeling?
I actually came away from there with a wonderful feeling. I felt much better about it than I ever expected to. And I really, you know, when it originally came up, I called Minuteman and I said, MTV is going to be following me. And I'm thinking about bringing them to Texas to meet you, or, you know, something. And I threw out a bunch of ideas, and he says, why don't you take them to Duncan to meet Charles? And I said, okay. And so I kind of From there, it kind of oscillated back and forth between we were going to have a bunch of people there and then we couldn't have a bunch of people there. And so when I showed up, I absolutely had no idea what to expect. And Charles and his family were so wonderful and such wonderful people. And it was MTV originally went there because they just wanted to film me meeting with someone. And in the beginning, the producers said to me, you know, we're not going to be able to shoot or we're not going to be able to put much of your interview with Charles in because it's such a big subject and it's too much for us to get into the show and it's too much for us to cover, you know, his whole court case and all of that. And after they filmed the interview, they called their head producer and they came back to me and they said, we are actually going to put more of Charles's story in there. Because they were so, you know, so interested in his story. And that was wonderful. And, you know, I've really become, very motivated to do everything that I can to help his family because they absolutely are wonderful people who absolutely are being persecuted unjustly and it's outrageous. So, you know, I got all mushy hearted after the whole thing. And I'm really glad we went and I'm really glad, you know, I mean, it was, his parents were so happy that there were people who cared and that there were people who were there trying to help. And that in itself was worth, you know, everything that we could have done and more. So I felt like the trip was a huge success. I felt really good about it personally, and it's given me a different way to go about explaining to people what is wrong and what the real problems are. You know, if you look at Charles's case and you look at the huge amounts of civil rights violations that he has endured through government agencies and through people who actually really don't have the authority to do any of the things that they've done to him, that case in itself is a wonderful way to explain to people who don't understand what we think is so wrong that our government is doing. So, you know, there were a lot of different reasons to feel good about it, and I'm really happy we went.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. You know, and it's, you know, and you're very right. You know, it's not just Charles Dyer. It is so many people out there. We can go back decades. You know, we can go back to the 60s when the police state started forming in the U.S. with the creation of SWAT teams. And we can go to Ohio State and look at the shootings that happened there. We can go to Berkeley. We can go to the Watts riots. We can go and go and keep going. We can look at Waco. We can look at Ruby Ridge. We can look at Charles Dyer and so many others who, for doing nothing more than speaking out and for standing firm on their beliefs and their principles, they were persecuted. Some were murdered. I call it murder. I don't care what, you know, what the police investigations into their own people called it. I know that when one single sniper at Ruby Ridge and at Waco shoots unarmed children and never goes to jail for either instance, that's a clear conflict of interest. So, you know, I don't care what they call it. If I shoot an unarmed individual, especially a child, that's murder. I don't care. It's murder.
Right.
You know, when we stop standing up for each other and we stop being willing to fight for one another, we're lost. We've already lost.
And a lot of, you know, I have a lot of people who ask me, you know, what is it that our government's doing that is so wrong? And, you know, you can recite numerous different things, and you can recite things like Waco and Ruby Ridge, and but when you have a current story of somebody who, this is a family who is currently going through this, I think that helps bring it home to a lot of people.
Well, a lot of the people out there also, they're not old enough to remember Waco or Ruby Ridge. They just weren't old enough or they weren't even born yet. So you're right. You know, we have our, you know, but the point was we need to start standing up and helping each other because we didn't do it 20 years ago. We didn't do it 40 years ago.
Right. Absolutely. And that's actually about 8 months ago. I've been writing articles for Human Events and Guns and Patriots for about a year now. And about 8 months ago, I called up my editor and I said, I want to do a series on all of these patriots who are being persecuted, and I want to drive around the country and write articles on them. And he said, okay, you know, when you figure out how to pay for that, call me and I'll publish them. But it's, you know, it's been something that's been in my mind a lot. And I kind of put it on the back burner because of the CECOM meeting and other projects we were working on. And it was really neat to be able to actually go and do the first of that series. And it kind of revitalized my interest in that. And my concentration on how important it is to tell people's story who don't currently have a voice because it's hidden. And I think that's a really important thing to the whole movement.
No, I agree. You know, in fact, you know, in the chat room, I've noticed some comments in there. A lot of people seem excited about how well-spoken you are. And one of them even made the comment, you know, a new woman, a new spokesperson for the militia. So, you know, I think the thing that you've done so far have been impactful. I think that you're on the right idea. I think that you are able to show a different persona, a different image of the militia than, you know, what a typical militia guy might. I mean, like I said, you're not the typical militia person or who the media portrays as a typical militia. I mean, I've got 3 bachelor's degrees. I made 6 figures a year. I've been militia since I was 17. You know, so, I mean, the problem is we don't have enough of those kind of people. You know, we don't have enough spokesmen out there. I that's what I truly believe. I don't think we have enough spokesmen and statespeople out there yet really preaching the truth and really portraying the true image of the militia and our founding and our constitutional rights.
Right. And that was one of the things that MTV asked me. He said, you know, what is it that you want your videos and your articles to show that, you know, videos like Charles's don't? And I said, well, you know, Charles is military. And that's intimidating to a lot of people, and a lot of people can't relate to that. And a lot of the other militia videos that you see on YouTube are some guy sitting in a basement in camo with a gun. And I said, you know, and I understand the reason for that, and I support that, and I think it's great, but that does intimidate a lot of our culture that could, you know, if they saw somebody they felt like they could relate to, could listen better and could understand better and, you know, really might come around to be on our side of the fence on things. So I think that's a major thing that I want to focus on is, you know, me in a suit or me in a dress smiling in a, you know, a sunny meadow somewhere and saying, this is what we believe in, this is what we stand for. And I think that as many different views of militia members as we can have like that shows people that militia are everyone. They are your brothers, they are your sisters, they are your cousins, you know, they're everybody, and we're not just one stereotype. So, you know, that's a major thing that I hope to work on is getting out some videos and different things that show that, you know, we're pretty little college girls too. You know,
good for you. Listen, I hope it goes well, and I want to thank you for everything you're doing. I know that you have another thing that you need to get to. Do you have to go to that right now? I looked at the clock. I noticed that we're...
Yeah, I have a couple more minutes.
Okay.
And if I could, I would just like to talk about the workshop that
we've
set up so far.
We'd love for you to do that. Let's start talking about some CECOM stuff then.
Beautiful. So this meeting that we have on April 30th, the idea is that in the CECOM area, which is the Southeast Constitutional Militias, it is Georgia, Florida, South Carolina, Mississippi, Tennessee, and Alabama. And CECOM is just a regional designation. And the idea is that it's an umbrella group that will supply support and help aid and facilitate communication between all of the groups in that area. So this meeting will be the first CECOM multi-state meeting, and the idea is that it's a workshop format. We will have people who are specialize in certain areas from all of the different states, host workshops where they will present how they think that this a given thing could best work in their area. And then the other people will have input on how to make that work for everyone and how to tweak it so that it is actually something viable that we can put in an SOP for CECOM. So we have, so far the workshops are standard COMO equipment like ham radios, what kind of get, portable antennas, how to make them, repeaters, things like that. COMO procedures, which is just, you know, what to say, what not to say. We're going on all ends of the spectrum. We're going from beginning to advanced, because there are groups who want to start a new group and have no knowledge at all. And then there are people who specialize in this and have been working on it for a long time. So we're trying to network everyone in as well. We have a COMO line designation and actual implementation throughout the Southeast, which is actually the meeting that I have to go to, is a large group that I'm trying to get on board for helping with that workshop. We have a gentleman who's going to do basic militia medical, so basic items that each person should carry on themselves, and then basic items that a militia medic should have, basic training that everyone needs, PR materials. We have a guy who does pamphlets, business cards, T-shirts, you know, does a lot of community outreach materials. I am going to lead a workshop on the lobby that I have formed, which represents all Patriot groups. I've been speaking at Tea Party meetings. I've been speaking at all kinds of different meetings. And the idea behind the lobby is to unite as many different constitutionally based Patriot groups as possible. So we have a voice at our state and federal levels with our representatives. I'm talking to some people about doing a workshop on committees of safety. Actually, I wanted to call you back and talk to you about this at a different time as well.
I got two favorite subjects in the world, militia and committees of safety, so anytime.
I'm
more than happy to talk about those anytime.
Beautiful. We are going to have a workshop on regional designation for the rest of the United States. So we're going to have people sit down and work on, you know, what the regional breakdown for each other area should be. We are going to have a workshop on membership issues, which is like infighting, grievance committees, new member orientation, things like that. A workshop on affordable basic gear for new members, and how to get that. And a workshop on recruiting, ideas on how to, where to, when to. We have a lot of people who really specialize in recruiting, and they have a lot of really basic, simple ideas that are very successful. And then intro to basic necessary training for each new member, like on tactical movement, hand signals, land nav, things like that. So we also we're still picking up workshops as well. At the moment, it looks like we're going to have between 100 and 200 people at this meeting. And so the idea is that we'll have the workshops running in about three or four at a time and have them running in shifts because it's just one day on a Saturday. So we have to do the best that we can to utilize our available time. So that's I just wanted to run through that list because I've been working on trying to stick names with that list. And White Owl can absolutely explain any or all of those in more depth as well. But I'm going to run. But thank you very much for having me on. And it was nice talking to you.
Oh, it was always a pleasure. You take care, Amelia. Thank you for coming on. I appreciate it. And I really want to thank you for all the efforts you're putting in and doing what you're doing out there. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, White Owl. That leaves you and me, man. How are you?
Yeah, I'm all you've got left now, Randy.
So how are you doing?
Very good. Very good.
All right. Well, let's spend the rest of the time then talking about CECOM because Amelia brought up some interesting topics there, and I really wanted to go into some of these things. The why. So let's start with this. Why did you feel there was a need for CECOM?
Well, communication primarily and coordination. The problem is, and I've seen this on all of the militia websites as well as several concerned Americans on different social networking sites about a unified voice, and that's never going to happen without coordination. And because people are so divided in many of their beliefs and backgrounds, I thought that the first thing to do was to try to get a state meeting together, get just the groups in your state together. Well, I was beat to the punch by a great patriot by the name of Rick Pollard. You may have seen Rick on the Well-Regulated American Militias. He's very active and put together a state, what he called a state leadership meeting. This was just a very small units, you know, 8 to 12 guys who trained together, you know, and they're each leader coming from around the state. And within a couple of those meetings, you know, he was trying to duplicate many of the things that we were doing with CECOM. In order for us to get nationwide, as far as having communication, am I breaking up, Randy?
No, you're good.
Oh, okay, I heard something in the background. I thought when this...
No, I'm sorry. No, my father-in-law's in town. The TV's on in the background, so that's that background noise you're hearing.
Okay. In order for us to have communication and standards nationwide, we're going to have to start in smaller increments. And having close relationships with militias not only in your state but also in the states around you, I thought was imperative for many reasons. One, you know, we're a mobile society. People don't always stay right where they live. And they may spend years forming relationships in the militia they're in and then move to a state or two away. Work may move them or family issues, a million reasons. If we had a standardized training for all of the militias in the area, you could move from one area from a CECOM team to another area that has a CECOM team and fit right in. You wouldn't have to start over again. You could pick up right where you left off.
You know, the concept that you bring up is, it's an old concept. I mean, if you look back at our founders' days, our well-regulated militia were all basically taught this, you know, similar training. One group could meet up and form up with another group and basically know what each other was doing. I mean, training might differ from area to area, you know. The training in Florida would be...
I'm sorry, Brandy, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
I was going to say the training, you know, that happened in, you know, like the southern states might be a little bit different than in the northern states that was going on for different regions, but the training was pretty much standardized. In fact,
absolutely.
We've got, Gary's got a book on his website, outpost-freedom.com, that has a book that was reproduced from the 1700s, I think even before the Revolution, in fact, that talks about the standardized training of the militia of the various provinces.
Well, my background isn't nearly as interesting as Amelia's in leading me to militia. I'm pretty typical, Midwestern born, BB gun when I was 6 and my first shotgun at 9, military service. And,
Hang on, real quick. Is there a volume control? Do you have a volume control on your phone by any chance? I guess some people have a little bit harder time hearing you.
Okay, is it too low? Is that the problem?
No. No, a little bit more volume. Some people are having a hard time hearing you. If you could up your volume a little bit, I can't boost your volume any more than I'm on it.
How's that? Is that better?
Well, you're clear on my end, but I've got a direct line to you. You're not being rebroadcast or streamed over the internet with me, so we'll try that and see if that's any better. Also, if anybody out there, also for those listening, also there's a volume control on the player as well. It's on the very right hand side. Put your cursor over that, click it, and take it all the way to the very end. That'll up your volume as well. So I'm sorry for interrupting you. I'm sorry for interrupting you there.
Oh no, not a problem. I apologize for not being able to be heard. I've got this about as loud as it will go. You still there?
I'm still here. So now the organization
in the military.
Okay, go ahead. Sorry about that.
Yeah, as you know, in conventional military, you have structures all the way down to battle buddies, up from battle buddy to fire team to squad, platoon, company, and so forth. And entire brigades will train to a single standard so that if you move units or, God forbid, need replacements because of loss of personnel, everybody's trained to the same standard. This is a secondary reason for the necessity in having a regional organization. Now, keep in mind that CECOM is not, I want to make this very clear, it is not a regional force in any way, shape, or form. There is no commander of CECOM. There is no leader of CECOM. It is still broken down into small units, with each with their own trainers and leaders. CECOM is just an umbrella group of those individual units.
Okay, so basically then, because that was going to be a question I was going to ask you, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So basically what you have is CECOM is basically then just an organization that's being used to help those militias that want to engage and participate to get on the same page.
Exactly. It is that simple. Now, I've been working with an attorney, and he sent me an email when I was out of town. I've got to answer him today, tonight. His name is Richard Fry, and he's out of Kansas. And Mr. Fry had a successful civil litigation practice for many years and got tired of civil law. And I guess he considered his success was enough and has dedicated the last 4 years of his life to constitutional law.
Mm-hmm.
He apparently has worked with several patriot groups around the country trying to explain, and he's been looking desperately for militia involvement to explain exactly. Mr. Fry believes that militia is not, and obviously he backs this up with law, it is not a voluntary force. It is a civic duty that is required by the citizens of this country to give back to the country that they enjoy. And he absolutely agrees with you that militia must be subordinate to a civil authority. Now, because the committees of safety, and again, this is an area that I know you know much more about than I do, and this is where I might be recruiting your assistance. Because there are no established committees of safety, according to Mr. Fry, the law now, for us to be completely legal, we are to be subordinate to certain representatives of the state. He and I have debated that back and forth, and I've explained to him that's never going to happen because most of us probably wouldn't be involved in militia if we trusted the state and federal government to do the right thing on our behalf. But with the implementation of committees of safety and basically allowing, and now tell me if I'm off the mark here, if we just sit back and allow the government to implode on itself, no cause anything, just allow them to finally deal themselves their own death blow, and have the committees in safety in place, committees of safety in place, to kind of pick up the communities in that aftermath. Is that part of the intention that you or purpose that you envision?
Actually, yes. Basically, everything that we promote on this show, all the ideas that we promote, are not ours. They're not Gary's ideas or my ideas. What we've done is we've taken the very actions of our founding fathers, those things that were lawful and constitutional for them then in Magna Carta, that they implemented and they used to create our country, our society. And those things they
right.
kept up even afterwards. I mean, the committees of safety didn't just go, yes, the committees of safety stopped being the government, you know, with the Continental Congress. They stopped being the government upon the creation of the Articles of Confederation. Yet if you look
right.
back, throughout history, you'll find that those areas, like the frontiers, they still had committees of safeties. They still used them, and they
right.
still implemented them. So the committees
now,
of safeties.
I didn't ask you that, saying that it's yours or Gary's ideas. I'm deferring to your superior knowledge in
right, right.
In those areas. And I can see from what I've read and learned from you and others, committees of safety evolved into Congress. For lack of a better word, I mean, lack of a better explanation. And now
they became the government. They took over. They took the control of their areas, and they became the lawful government. Or
right.
maybe not so lawful at the time, but they became the lawful government afterwards. Yes,
okay.
They were proactive,
and that was an evolutionary process, and it eventually became the Continental Congress and so forth.
Correct.
Is that correct? Okay. Now that we are seeing the destruction by our representatives, the destruction of our government, it's starting to devolve, and therefore committees of safety may once again be necessary.
Exactly, and you know, everything that we're talking about here is not waiting for that end game to come to us. It's about being proactive and engaging now. Controlling, it's like a chess game. It was like a chessboard. Whoever controls the flow of that game is going to win because you control the course of the events. Right now, we're leaving the control of the board up to our government, and we're waiting for them to do whatever. I mean, I hear so many people out there saying, well, when the government does this, 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 and this, we'll stand up. Well, they've done all that already many times over. Each item that we say that we won't stand for, they've done it many times in the past. So when will we begin to act? When will we begin to stand up and say, we've had enough, we're taking our country back now, as peacefully as possible, hopefully with never a shot fired, but hey, if you force us to go that route, then we will begin to go that route as well with you. You know, that's the problem.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I have a friend who taught me that when you create something, try to create it as if it is already much larger than it actually is. That way you're not constantly putting out fires and experiencing growing pains. Now, this is the purpose for CECOM. Once committees of safety are at outside of neighborhood and municipal size, possibly county, state committees of safety, we don't know what's going to happen in the future with the separate states and separate state lines. I mean, anything can happen, and we're in the business of preparing for anything. Committees of safety, once they're established, then CECOM will have someone to direct it and will have someone to actually be called, for lack of a better term, the head of it or a group of someones. But at this point right now, there is no one that is, and I really need to keep it that way for many reasons, so that, you know, people, first of all, are comfortable in understanding that it doesn't change anything that they don't want it to change.
Exactly. Now, I've got a question for you. One of the main concerns that I have is when we look back at the history of the militia, and if we look at the Constitution itself, it's the militia of these several states, not a militia of these regional states or anything like that. It's a militia of these several states, meaning that each militia was only within their state realms. Now, like you said, the CECOM isn't trying to be the militia itself. It's trying to be an organization that helps get everybody on the same page. Now, what about the organizations that are part of CECOM? Are they going to be CECOM of Florida, CECOM of this, CECOM of that?
Well, in Florida alone, we have four or five different CECOM units. They wear the CECOM shield, but their unit designator is different at each. I mean, the shield itself is just the unifying symbol. If you encounter that shield in the field, you know that's someone that has trained with CECOM or under their standards, and you'll recognize them as a brother in arms. The shield is. The center portion of the shield is up to each and every small unit, even if it's only three men. Three guys train together all the time, know each other inside and out, know their capabilities and how they function together. If they decide to become part of CECOM, they are authorized to take the shield and change the center of it to whatever their particular unit designation is within that state.
Okay, perfect. So then the militias, so then those various militias would remain autonomous. They would remain whatever they were, the Ohio Minutemen Militia, so forth. They would still remain the Ohio Minutemen Militia. They have their own command structure. They do not answer to you guys. They are still sole and separate and state militia.
Absolutely. The only thing we cannot, no one in CECOM can tell another CECOM unit what to do. The only thing that can be done is what not to do. Criminal activity will absolutely get you removed from a CECOM umbrella.
Okay, perfect. No, that's good to know, because I know that there's in fact I was part of an organization that started up. They tried it before, you know, back in the 90s. Linda Thompson brought up the United States Militia. I guess you forgot that the only United States Militia is the, you know, is the conjoined militia of the of these United States mustered by the commander in chief. Last I checked, she wasn't the commander in chief, so I don't know how the hell she could create the United States militia.
Right.
But these are things that we always see. We always see these national groups try to create national militia groups, which in itself is a violation of the very Constitution that we say we're upholding. I don't see how we can have that and still remain constitutional.
That has been part of the issue that I've been working with the constitutional attorney on. in trying to make sure that we are adhering to the law that we insist our elected representatives adhere to.
And that's exactly it. I mean, you know, the Constitution is, you know, if we say that we uphold the Constitution in all aspects of it, then we can't, you know, we have to uphold it in all aspects, even those parts that might not work with what we're trying to do. You know, we
Absolutely.
Might have business for something else, but hey, if the Constitution says that's not lawful, that's not the way it is, that's not, we can't do it. You know, we can't treat
right.
the Constitution like a Chinese food buffet, like these, you know, like our representatives are. They treat it like a Chinese food buffet. They take what they like, they leave the rest. You know, and we can't begin to do that either.
We'd be the epitome of hypocrites if that's what we did.
Agreed. So, you know, that's part of what we try to do on this show is to show what the founders did, because, you know, we can try to read what the Constitution says, but again, like all of our politicians, everybody has their own idea of it. But if we look at what the founders did, we can gather the meaning of it from those actions and the colonists' actions at the time. For instance, you had brought up the fact of gun control. Well, after the Constitution, I could still go out and buy a ship and load it up with 100 cannons if I wanted to, the equivalent of a battleship today.
Right.
You could do that
right.
then. So obviously, that was the intent.
Yeah,
I could buy a cannon and shot and have it in my front yard. Obviously, that was the intent.
if you read clearly through the Federalist Papers as well as the letter, down to the core meaning of the Second Amendment, by all rights, we should have access to, if we have the money for it, access to Apache helicopters and Abrams tanks.
We were the defense of this country. Remember, our military was supposed to remain small to protect our harbors, our waterways, and a small marine group or whatever you want to call it. But our defense was supposed to be militia. You know, and there was never any distinction made between unorganized or organized. There was just militia. That distinction of unorganized and organized came about much later, after changes started being made that were not lawful either. You know, the militia was the militia. That's all there was to it. It was the fighting and defense force of every town, every county, and every state.
And this is the basis for Mr. Fry's argument that militia is not voluntary. It is a civic duty. You should have a feeling of duty to protect your homeland.
That's it. That's it, you know. But at the same time, though, we say it was every man, able-bodied male between this age and this age, and for the most part, that was true. There were some exceptions to it, you know. But we forget
right.
what that means. We had a collective responsibility to protect ourselves, not only from foreign threats, but also from our own government. And the only way to do that was one with the First Amendment, and when that was completely and utterly ignored, then with the Second Amendment, if need be.
Roger that.
And it wasn't just
exactly
for home defense or for hunting. It was for our government, and the Founding Fathers clearly stated that.
Well,
you know, Jefferson stated that.
They understood history much better than most Americans alive today, and they knew exactly the pattern that all governments follow. Eventually, all empires crumble, and the reason for it is often greed and corruption.
You know, that's where we start to break down it. When we forget what the Constitution says and we try to do things on our own without really understanding what it is we're trying to do, we lose it then. Like I mentioned, you know, national militia organizations, illegal. Illegal is all hell. I don't know any other way to put it. They're just illegal as all hell. It's a paramilitary organization, and the only commander that national militia organization would have would be the commander-in-chief. Not somebody, you know, not somebody outside of that commander in chief. And it could only be, and you would have to have the consent of Congress in order to raise it. Because each state, just like Washington, when Washington wanted to muster the Continental Army, he had to go to each governor and get their permission to bring those militia out of their states. They didn't have to let them go.
Yeah. Right. Now, and correct me if I'm wrong here, the founders also, I believe, envisioned when government. I don't even think they ever thought if. I think they voiced the words when government becomes oppressive, then it's the right of the people, not only the right, but the duty of the people to cast off those chains. Now, in reference to a national militia, no. And then CECOM, well, that's not what it's about at all. Again, it's standardized training only. It's no more national than well, any organization that even uses the word national. CECOM is about only getting the groups together, because many people are sorely lacking in training. And as far as defensive and protective tactics go, you can make those uniform so that each member understands exactly their position. Now, when it comes to survival training, it has to be a more regional thing, because the flora and fauna in Florida is much different than it is in Oklahoma.
Well, I agree. So let's go on to some of the other aspects of CECOM then, if you don't mind, getting back to that, because
sure.
I really want to dig into that. I mean, that's the whole point of you being on this broadcast, is to talk about this.
Okay.
Training and everything. I'm assuming that there's going to be some standard basic, you know, some form of standard basic training, like you said, basic to advanced levels, correct?
Yes.
Now, do you have people that are actually qualified putting these training regimens together? You know, small squad tactics, sniping, whatever it is.
Yeah. If you're talking about the defensive and protective portions of our training, because now my squad is known as the Florida Charter Oaks. We're just a small unit in Florida. We train to operate completely independent of all outside support. For as long as possible. Now, granted, a small infection can result in the loss of a limb in the field, but as far as food procurement, water, medicine, sustained living in harsh conditions, we attempt to train to a level that we can operate in the field for an extended period of time with no support and no resupply. Not all units can do that. That's just what we focus on. Now, Amelia has put together a pretty good list of people who seem to know their areas of expertise. And we haven't received all of their training outlines yet and had a chance to review those. We're not trying to reinvent the wheel. There are, when it comes to protective and defensive tactics, obviously, we refer to several of the FM manuals with the military, as well as special operations, Ranger Handbook, Special Forces operations. Most of the trainers that I have found in Florida that are good at those types of operations are former military and it wasn't classroom. It was practical and tactical application in real world prior to them joining militia. We are going to be meeting a lot of new people. So for me to say that every subject that will be talked about by someone that is at an expert level, I'd be speaking out of school to say that, because I have not met all of these people yet. However, if they have displayed a proficient level of knowledge, and we really, really look to see that they combine their knowledge and experience with ethics and morals. Because what we train to do is often critical, not just in surviving, but possibly having to defend our lives with lethal force.
Well, I can't disagree with that at all. I think that's one of the problems that we have today is, again, we like everything else in our patriot movement, we're 10,000 different groups with 10,000 different ideas focused on 10,000 different things doing and running in 10, and having 10,000 different plans. Our militia in the old days, you could take a militia from, New York and it could fight alongside a militia with, from Tennessee. And they could work fairly well together. They would understand the same things. They could work fairly well together.
This was brought to light to me in person back in November, October, November, at the end of last year, when many members of our unit went out upon request to Arizona to help patrol and secure the borders. and we, you know, attempted initially to work alongside many of the Arizona units. And within, you know, within the first 48 hours, we knew that we were going to have to operate independently of them because of completely different training levels and experience. It really highlighted the fact that, I mean, God bless those patriots out there. They spend all of their money and their free time trying to help Border Patrol and Bureau of Land Management Rangers, who, by the way, are very, very receptive to militia involvement out there. Despite what you hear in the news, they are very happy to have militia there, because often these are 22 to 25-year-old young men riding around in a marked vehicle in cartel drug territory by themselves. They are absolutely rolling targets. And when they have 9, 10, 12 guys back them up, they're very happy to have militia there. But we did absolutely see extremely different standards, and it did not lend itself to unit cohesion when Florida members were involved with Arizona members. We'd like to avoid that in the future.
Well, you know, that was another thing. I've talked to a lot of people out there, that were involved in the border ops. In fact, a lot of people that I know went out there because of the shows that I've done in the past, and I've talked to them about their experience afterwards, and the horror stories abound. Everything from people that had no idea what they were doing to, you know, like you were mentioning, the groups, you know, the various units could not work together cohesively because of differing training. You know, everything from, you know, comms protocol to whatever. It doesn't matter, but whatever it was. There was things keeping them from working together as a cohesive unit. And that's a problem.
Well, and it's worse than not being able to be effective. It's actually dangerous. Because if you've got two units in the field who do not have comm, don't have a standardized training, and it's, you know, a moonless desert night, one may misinterpret the other as a drug cartel. Or mistake the other for a drug cartel, and then you have a disaster on your hands. But again, like I said, I still have to give my kudos to those fine gentlemen and women who go out there and spend their own time, their own money, to do whatever they can to help. At least, you know, they're attempting to do something.
Now, you mentioned the the fact that you've started to get a regional thing for CECOM going, the Southeast region. In fact, I know somebody who's going to be, I know a few people that are going to be heading down there. One of them is Equalizer, the commander for the Ohio Minuteman Militia.
I look forward to meeting him.
He's a good man. OHMM is one of those groups that I support wholeheartedly. In fact, if things ever go south and I have to hit, and I jump back down to the States, I'm heading in one or two directions, Washington or Ohio. That's how much, how much faith I have in those, in the Ohio Minuteman Militia. Cross and Equalizer are just two incredible commanders up there, and I can't, and everybody that I've met from Ohio Minuteman Militia is spot on. They understand the role, they understand the law, they understand the militia. You know, I've found very little, if anything, that I've got to correct on their ideology or showing history where they're inaccurate in their thinking. These guys are spot on. They do their homework. So I think you guys will really get along down there, and I'm looking forward to hearing back some good things about CECOM from them. But what about the Northeast, Northwest, Midwest, Southwest?
Right.
Anything working on there? Have you guys gotten any word from anybody, or have you guys made progress in creating a Northwest COM or anything?
Not Northwest at this moment. However, as you probably gathered, Amelia is somewhat ambitious in getting people organized, and she has been speaking to several people. I believe she did speak to Equalizer. CECOM will do, we're going to do our best to work the bugs out of this, and we're going to be able to tell at the end of this or during the course of it what works, what's beneficial, and what we should toss away. And once we get through this first Southeast meeting, we're planning on traveling to other places, meeting with other groups to help them set up the exact same thing in their areas.
I spoke with members of the ACS out in Arizona just today about doing that very thing with Arizona and a couple of the states around it. I know that that Minuteman of well-regulated American militias is also planning to do the same thing in the Texas area.
Mm-hmm.
So CECOM will be, I mean, it's our maiden voyage into this. We're going to learn a lot about what works and what doesn't with CECOM. And I'm going to plead with Equalizer not to come back and tell you any horror stories about how badly it was working.
The good thing with Equalizer is he tells the truth. Even if it's good, bad, or indifferent, he will tell the truth. It's funny. He even, one of the things that I really like about Equalizer and Major Cross is that even with me, you know, they didn't just take my ideas and run with them. Those guys researched everything that I had said, the ideas we presented. They researched them for months. They read, and only then did they come on board and say, you know, Randy, you're right. We support this. Let's get on board. So, you know, they're good guys. They are active, and they are doing that. And also, something else, you know, you had kind of brought this up with what ACS is doing and other people, you know, Minuteman, you know, Rick Light in Texas. You know, these are things that we should be thinking about in our own individual states, our own individual counties. We should be getting together with each other and working on getting some cohesion with each other, some standard operating protocols, communication protocols, things like that. We should be doing this anyways.
Well, and that has been bantered about and discussed by many groups across the nation for quite a while. And in a conversation I had with Minuteman several weeks ago, he said to me that I've been doing this for 20 years, and I do not see that as a badge of honor. I see it as a badge of failure because we have not accomplished what we need to. And in, you know, the old saying of doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results, well, I think that Amelia is trying to have a new, fresh approach. And the other problem that you have when you say, and you're absolutely right, we should be doing this on our county level and our state level as much as possible. But the problem that you have often is enough personnel or even any personnel. We get contacted by people from all over the country who are isolated in their region. They know no one. They're calling us and saying, do you know anyone in my area? I'd like to get out and start training, you know, but I'm all by myself. It's me in my backyard with my dog. And this is where the recruiting and retention will come in. First, like the Charter Oaks, we are from all over the state of Florida. We're not from one particular county. And Charter Oaks is that is a voluntary organization. You know, they like what we do when we're in the field. We train hard, we work hard, and we treat each other with courtesy and respect. So those people are willing to travel sometimes up to 5 hours to train with us. But finding a full, even squad sized, with two fire teams and a squad leader, 9 people in one particular county, is often very difficult for people.
True. I mean, well, you know, if we look back at our militia of old, every town had its own militia. Every village, hamlet, whatever you wanted to call it, they all had their own individual militia. Everybody in that area was involved, you know, according to what their laws said, you know, Magna Carta beforehand, the articles afterwards, or the Constitution. And this is the way they were. You know, now we are so spread out that, you know, sometimes it's hard getting 9 guys together that are in a county.
Roger that. And it's not just being so spread out. I believe that recruiting
so,
militia,
so little involvement
militia
as well.
Participation. I'm sorry?
And so little involvement as well. I mean, I hear people that say they can't even get a fire team together.
Right. Well, see, the problem is, Randy, and this is unfortunate, but I believe that recruiting for militia back in colonial days was far easier than it is now for two reasons. One, those men were just plain tougher than we are. I mean, that's just the bottom line. They were, you know, they, I mean, just to get a cup of coffee in the morning, you started with you getting up and going to the well. Living the simple life makes you a much hardier soul than living the soft life that we live in America today. And secondly, there was no often a county sheriff or any type of protection for the people who weren't able to protect themselves. So it was your duty to watch out for your neighbors and care about your community, because if you didn't, it could be destroyed overnight. You know, it's unfortunate that people have Dancing with the Stars and Jersey Shore to occupy their mind and their time, to keep them from reading history and caring about their community. But that is the world that we live in. That's why it's difficult to even put together a fire team in many counties.
Well, you know, I think that we really need to get back to, like you said, they were a different breed of men back then. My father-in-law is in town, and him and I have these discussions quite often. In fact, that's one of the great things. You know, one of the things that I really like about him is that I'm able to discuss deep intellectual ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And solutions for these problems that we have with him, and we can go all day and all night, and we can just keep progressing the conversation. Unfortunately, we don't have those type of people much anymore. We don't have the people that we used to have. I mean, I was the norm back in the days. Now I seem to be, you know, people like you and me, we seem to be the exception. We were the norm.
Yes. Yes.
We were the norm. You and I would have just been everyday run-of-the-mill guys just talking about the average everyday stuff. You know, we're talking about militia, but, you know, this was the norm. We would not have been considered.
Well, the norm now, I'm afraid, Randy, I was at a restaurant the other day. We had some bad storms move through Florida, and it was raining in the parking lot when I came outside a restaurant, and a couple came out. The guy, he was about, I would say, 26, 27 years old, 6'4", broad shoulders, looked like a football player, shaved head. And she said, "Would you mind going to get the car and bringing it up here?" And he started whining right away about it. It was raining. It was raining.
What are we going to do?
When I told Amelia about this, I said, I hope that was her brother, not her boyfriend. You know, I mean, that's what we're dealing with on a large scale. Of course, there are exceptions, and we have some outstanding young men. Unfortunately, many of them are being chewed up in Afghanistan, Iraq, and now they're likely to be deployed to other locations as well.
You know, we really used to be much more engaged in our society, and that's one of the problems we have today. We are no longer engaged in our community. We are no longer engaged in our society. We're no longer engaged in our own homes. Most of our kids, I mean, I'll be honest with you, I've spoken with patriots, you know, so-called, and I use the word, I use finger quotes every time I say the word patriot.
Right.
You know, but I've talked to so many patriots, you know, and I look at their kids who are 12, 13, 14 years old, and they don't know anything that their parents are talking about. What happened?
Oh, yes, we have, you're absolutely, we have disengaged.
What happened?
We have disengaged right down to, look at it this way. You talk to any teenager right now, a young teenager, 13, 14 years old, and I just saw a study where they're developing carpal tunnel because of their constant texting. While you're talking to them, they might be looking at you and nodding their head, and they've got their cell phone down under the table texting a friend. They don't hear a word you're saying. And, you know, technology has made it that way for us, and we've allowed it to happen every step of the way.
You know what, that's something we've got to take care of in the future as well. So, you know, I'm really excited about the fact that, you know, I'll be honest with you, like I said before, there's other groups out there that are trying to form national organizations. And at first, when I first started hearing about this, and what you guys were looking at doing, you know, you had mentioned the, one of the posts that I had done on RAM, you had brought up the fact that you guys were creating an internal conflict resolution, department as well. So, you know, I had questions about a lot of the things that you guys were doing, and one of my questions was, is there going to be like a, C, Florida, C, North, South Carolina, C, Georgia, where there is a regional CCOM group that oversees and commands everything and everyone, like other national groups that are out there now or have been in the past.
Absolutely not.
You know, I'm glad to hear that you guys are staying and remaining constitutional, And like I said, I'm willing to bring on anybody on the show, whether I disagree with them or whether I agree with them or disagree with them. In fact, I like to have people that I disagree with on as well, because we can start digging into ideas and find out the problems in those ideas or the benefits of them. Sounds like you guys are remaining very constitutional. You guys are keeping an eye on the bigger picture as well. What needs to be done? What can we do to be proactive today, right now?
And I will, with your permission, I'd like to call you privately sometime later and get as much of your input concerning several issues, including the committees of safety, if I may.
Oh, hey, not a problem at all. You know, I'm sorry. I've been busy the last week, everyone. My father-in-law came in four days early or something like that. We weren't expecting him until Sunday, but he came in earlier, so I haven't been able to get some of the stuff done that I said I was going to do. Family, like I always tell everybody, family takes precedence and priority. So, in fact, I was actually thinking about not doing the show tonight, but I knew I had you guys scheduled. I knew you guys were excited about being on, so I decided to do the show anyways.
Well, I appreciate that. Yes, I may contact you?
Yes, you may. No, please, by all means. My email is randymack@youhavetreadonme.com. Shoot me an email and I will shoot you back, you know, and I've got your phone number as well. I tried calling you, but your line, it just dumped me to voicemail, so I couldn't get with you. But no, I would love to talk with you personally, you know, privately, and we can go from there. But I'll be more than happy to talk to you about whatever you want, maybe learn something from you, and hopefully share something with you as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I need as much help as possible, and I know that Amelia will appreciate anything that you could do to help, because I'm not a West Point soldier. I was a field soldier, and organizing all of this is pushing my limits of capability. So I need all the help I can get.
Hey, not a problem. That's what we're all here for. You know, in fact, I'm actually trying to get other people as well versed in committees of safety as I've been able to become in them over the last 2 years with the tutelage of Gary Hunt. Yeah, you know, that way there's more people out there that can go and they can start teaching other people in their own areas. You know, I don't want to be the only spokesperson for this or the only teacher of this, so by all means, I would love to be able to teach you. And then you take these things to your area, just like, you know, you're trying to do a CCOM. You know, teach people and they can take it to their area and train others. So,
not a problem. And in reference to the grievance committees, if I can give you a real brief rundown of how that is, and this is not a permanent part of CCOM. Eventually, you know, the committees of safety would handle conflicts of that. But what we have now are several older members who are 70 years old or even older, who have been preppers for many, many decades. And they can teach things like how to purify multiple gallons of water per day or long-term food storage, things like that, and they want to be more involved. They can't go out in the field and train. You know, they have different physical infirmities or just age itself. You know, we have a bit of a heat and humidity issue in Florida. and I envision this kind of like the Indians used to do with the elders of the tribe. They because they're not strictly associated with any particular unit, taking these older members who want to contribute and having them hear grievances filed between individuals and between different units. Because people have problems. That's just the way it is. It's the way it will always be. People have problems in life and they have problems with each other. And what we've learned is in doing this, in having to explain yourself to another individual about why you're upset because somebody hurt your feelings, once you hear yourself talking about how minor this problem is, the problem often resolves itself right away. If not, then the committees can come back with, after listening to all sides and looking at all information, come back with what's called a resolution recommendation. This is what we recommend to solve this problem. Present it to all parties involved. And if it's accepted, fine, it's over. If it's not, if it's rejected by any party, then what they do is ask for a counter solution from the party that rejected whatever their recommendation was. And then, again, they say, this is what I think should happen. Then if it's resolved or if everyone accepts that resolution, it's over. If not, then it goes to the team leaders of whoever is involved in the conflict. You know, if it's one of the Florida Charter Oaks with one of the Southwest or the South Florida groups, then their team leader and I will come up with a solution, and that's it. That's not appealable anymore because you've made three attempts to resolve it. and people can either accept that or not. But, you know, these problems that go on and on and on, they have a tendency to have a ripple effect. And they, you know, because they'll start talking to their friends and it carries on and on. And then before you know it, you have two groups that won't even work together at all.
Agreed. I mean, you know, and I don't, you know, that's part of the problem we have today. I mean, we are going, you know, we have two choices. We're either going to stand united or hang divided. There is no option C.
Roger that.
There is no option C. So what are we going to do? You know, and that's the problem we come upon. You know, like you mentioned earlier, so many groups out there trying to do so many different things that are not beneficial or do not promote or do not advance our cause whatsoever. They are a waste of time, effort, and energy. And I'm actually, you know, after talking with you and really getting into what CCOM is about, I'm feeling that this organization is, you know, for the very fact that it's not trying to be the militia itself, but just like a AAA type organization, a support group, if you will, to get people on the same page with each other so they can work cohesively as a team, so they can make sure that people are actually trained. I get it. It's a good idea. It's a great idea, in fact. And, you know, I compliment you on getting it going.
Well, thank you very much. You know, I'm hoping that it does resolve a lot of the issues that we've been facing for at least 20 years. I say we as militia, you know, because obviously what we have been doing it's stalled, it's plateaued, and it's not going any further. We need to change our direction and instruction.
Well, I think that's true. In fact, you know, part of that is the history of the militia as well. I mean, this thing is so old, and, you know, the concept of militia has been around since the ancient days, although our concept of militia in the U.S. is much different than what militia was in other places throughout history. You know, we try to base our ideas on militia off what we look from, you know, like ancient Rome or whatever else. It's not the same concept. Rome could have probably, their militia could have probably been the closest we had to it, but, I mean, even then, it wasn't the same. It was not even, you know, there were similarities, but there was so much vastly different. And the problem is we've forgotten that damn history.
Well, yeah, it's not just historical differences. I mean, it's also cultural. The they call them resistance fighters or rebels in Libya now. They're militia.
Exactly. You know, I mean, you know, in fact, okay, well, let's look at them. You know, we're saying we call these people freedom fighters, yet the groups we're calling freedom fighters, you know, just a little bit ago, we called them terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda, Muslim Brotherhood. Just a little while ago, you know, Hillary Clinton was calling them terrorist organizations. Then they started calling those groups, you know, militia. You know, like the warlords and, you know, the warlords in Afghanistan. So they started referring to them as militia. Now we got Al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood in Libya and these other countries, northern African countries. And now Hillary is calling them freedom fighters. I'm so confused. You know, our militia is so much different.
I don't think she is.
You know, our militia is so much different.
One bit.
No, I know she's not. She knows exactly what's going on. There's a purpose. There's an agenda. She's not a stupid woman. And anybody who thinks she's a stupid woman, well, you know, they're not long for this world. They're pretty much going to be cannon fodder. These people are not idiots. They've managed to take over our country in a very short period of time. They're not idiots. And they did it so we didn't even know.
Right.
You know, the vast majority of Americans still don't know that their country is gone. It's gone.
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't exist anymore. So what are we going to do?
Well, you know, the unfortunate thing is you hit on this earlier, and I think it's a critical part of, we don't know our neighbors anymore. I mean, when we were villages and towns, and even when I was younger, you know, it was a small Midwestern town, we all knew each other. And we knew if there was a car in the driveway that didn't belong there or someone around the neighborhood that didn't live there, everybody was watching to see what their intentions were and what they were doing, watching out for their neighbors. We don't do that anymore. Now your neighbor is more likely to call the police on you because your music's too loud than they are to come over and knock on the door and say, "Hey, man, I got to sleep. Do you mind turning that down a bit?"
Well, agreed. And, you know, I think that one of these days we're actually going to, you know, I hope that it's sooner before later. But, again, I think that organizations that, you know, like what you and Amelia are trying to do there with CCOM are going to be some of those pivotal points in our history, our heritage, you know, our continued existence perhaps. If we're actually going to stand and take this, you know, and take our freedom back, It's going to be groups that actually try and promote some kind of standardization within the militia, some kind of unity within the Patriot community and organizations and other groups out there, and get us thinking about working on the same page that are going to make us or break us, that are going to determine our success or our failure. And that's the problem that we have today, is that we just forgot our history. We don't know it. I hear, just in the chat room alone, we're talking in the people are talking in the chat room, and some, I've watched it throughout as long as I've been online, and that, which isn't very long. I've only been online for a couple of years, but when you see the conversations that go into chat rooms and forum boards about militia, you wonder what books they read. Where are you getting this information from? And I think that's part of actually our biggest detriment right there, is we don't even know our history. So how can we engage in being militia, being committees of safety, when we don't know our own history and what they were and what they were about? How do we expect to retake our freedom when we don't even know about the one brand, about that one organization that we need in order to engage in any aspect of restoring our constitutional government? The committees of safety. I mean, as a republic, we have to work through representative bodies. That's a given. That's a norm. That's a standard. It has to be that way. That's a republic. We have to have representative bodies that we work through. Now, whether that's the actual government, like Congress or whatever, or a parallel government like the committees of safety were, either way it went, it was that government. And everybody had its role. The militia had its role, and people forget the militia cannot muster themselves. So who musters the militia?
And as I've been learning, everything that I've read so far and everything you said, I can agree with. I can't dispute anything yet.
Well, hey, no, if you can, man, let me know.
I'm saving that caveat.
Yeah, let me know if you can. No, hey, like I said, I am not one to promote myself. I don't even promote myself, really. I try to give ideas out there, but if I'm saying something wrong, by any means, everybody out there knows. You come and let me know. I'll correct it. There's no ego here, so please, by all means, if you find something invalid, you let me know. This where I'm learning along with everybody else, too.
I just saved that caveat because I never know when I'm going to come across something and say, oh, wait a minute, I got a question about this.
You question it. We should always do that with each other. So what is the – so about CECOM now.
Yeah.
What is the – as far as the – let's talk – I wanted to go into that little thing you talked about, the dispute committee.
Yeah.
It's interesting because we see so much of this, For instance, the militia of Georgia just recently had a little – I don't know, I haven't read through their bylaws or anything like that, but I know that historically nobody out there is really a constitutional militia yet, so we're not actually engaging in any of the lawful acts. But they kind of had a coup, if you could say that, or a replacing of the leadership, I guess you might say. I don't know. But I know that it caused a lot of disruption down there with the militia of Georgia.
That's my understanding. And from what I gather, that, I guess, has been going on for quite a while. It's not.
Yes, it's a monthly event. It seems like it's a monthly event, if not quarterly.
and if there was a grievance committee, then they could hear both sides of that. And this way, you don't have one individual or a group of individuals setting themselves up as a tyrant, saying, you're out. I've already seen the negative effects of that happening, even in Florida. So if you pass that off to a committee who is, as unbiased as it can be, and let them make the decisions, then that helps in a lot of different areas. Because, like I said, going through that process, one of two things is usually identified: what the true problem is, or the identification of a troublemaker. You just identify who the troublemakers in your midst. And there are those, some intentionally and some unintentionally. And one thing I forgot to mention also, in setting those up, you need at least a fourth and preferably a fifth alternate that would sit on the committee. Right now our committee is small. It's, it's only three people.
Mm-hmm.
But you need alternates in case a grievance is filed against a particular committee member.
Yes, I would think so.
Yeah,
You can't have the brother of somebody you're filing a complaint against sitting on that board.
Right. So when the grievance is put before the board, it's put before all members, even the alternates, so that they're up to speed in case, you know, first of all, one of the committee members may not be able to participate all the way to the end of the arbitration, because it is an arbitration or mediation, really, to resolve the issues as quickly and painlessly as possible. There are countless egos involved, and that really creates a big problem in the groups that are trying to form militias. That if we can find a way to remove that, we could remove 75% of our problems.
I think it would, you know, and, you know, like, you know, we are, well, you, I've already, you know, I've posted information about it, but, you know, Gary came up with an idea as well, and that idea actually stemmed from a dispute that myself and another individual was having. And, you know, just the pointlessness of it all. I mean, honestly, you know, when two people can't even, you know, when you're going back to he said, she said crap, all lines of communication are broken down. You know,
so. We should have learned that in junior high school, shouldn't we?
I had never played those games in junior high, so, you know, yeah, but we should have learned it from the sandbox days, you know, but we don't. So, you know, obviously we need an outside, you know, where we need to start thinking of ways to not only, you know, help settle some disputes, but something to maybe point out those, you know, those provocateurs, those people whose only job, it seems, is to create divide and confusion and chaos within our very rank, you know, within our very membership as well. We need to bring, you know, we need to, I think we need to have something to do that.
Yes.
You know, and if they're coming to fit.
Right now, it should be, I mean, the grievance committee that we have is only for Florida groups. You know, Georgia should have their own, South Carolina, you know, and each state should have a group of concerned patriots who care about what we stand for, but don't necessarily, you know, train with any particular group, so that they don't have a stronger loyalty to one group than another, so that their decisions are going to be more unbiased and fair.
Agreed. You know, I agree with that. You know, I think that everybody has a role to play, and I think that, you know, serving in a militia role is one role, serving on a committee role is another role, but there's other roles as well people can serve in. I mean, the vast majority of the people that were involved in the Revolutionary War weren't on the front line fighting, and they weren't serving in committees of safety. They were support. They were information. They passed along information. They passed along supplies. They gave food and shelter. They gave medical attention. There's many different roles that everybody can play. All we need to do all everybody needs to do is find that role where they fit in.
Absolutely. And those roles are even more critical than the proverbial war fighters. Because an unsupported team in the field has a very short life expectancy.
Well, you know, again, it goes back to our whole concept. You know, we cannot survive on our own. That's why we had tribes before. We started off, you know, with a family unit. Then families would merge together and form a tribe. Because even a family, I don't care if you have 10 people in your family, you can't survive on your own.
No, you can't. Thomas Paine wrote about that in a preamble to Common Sense, in that we form our societies based on our needs and wants, and we form our government based on our wickedness. you know, you can. I mean, that's what he said. You know how to shoe a horse, and I know how to repair leather boots, and she knows how to make cornbread. And, you know, I like cornbread, and I need shoes on my horse. You need shoes on your kids, and you know, so we all move together in societies to help support each other in that fashion. If we had an unwavering moral compass, we would never need government. We would work together harmoniously, understanding that without harmony, we would never be able to survive. However, we don't have that, and we have many members of our society that are just the wolves that feed on their prey, and they consume without contributing. Therefore, that creates a need for government.
And that's so very true. I mean, we form laws based upon our wickedness. And if you look at our, you know, our basic laws, that, you know, it goes back to don't kill, don't murder, don't steal, don't rape, things like this, to protect ourselves from each other, basically. Hence the representative form of government instead of a tyrannical or a monarchy. You know, but we wanted us to remain free. So, you know, But yeah, you're right. We form our governments based upon our wickedness.
Well, I wish it was mine, but it is absolutely Thomas Paine.
Well, yes, yeah. Thomas, you know, he was a, you know, I liked him in the beginning before, you know, he started getting kind of out there and kind of, he was actually kind of blacklisted at the end because he started going way on the deep side. But you know what? He was still a great thinker, and the things he said in the very, you know, in the beginning and towards the middle, you know, were just incredibly deep and insightful. I even like a lot of the stuff he said in later parts. It was just too advanced for his time period.
Roger that. I believe that's probably pretty close to truth.
You know, I think it was just too advanced for that time period. They weren't ready for it yet. It's kind of like Shakespeare going back to the 1200s.
I believe that if you have any other follow-up questions for Amelia, or I mean, or me, she's off of her conference call, so she's able to answer some more questions if you need.
Well, great, let's get her back in here. Well, basically, you know, we're down to about our last 15 minutes, so, you know, I'm going to let you decide where we're going to go with this now. I've asked the questions I have. I'm feeling very comfortable with the CECOM concept and idea. You know, I was kind of worried, you know, at first, like I said, you know, I had concerns and questions. You know, are you trying to become that national militia organization composed of several states? What is, you know, what's the story here? So why don't we do this? But we got about 15 minutes left. Why don't you take us where you want to go in these last few minutes, and let's talk about what you think we haven't covered yet.
All right. I'm going to have to put this phone back on speaker so that she can hear that question, and I'll let her take that. And if I have anything to add to what she says, I'll butt right in, if that's all right.
Not a problem. Yeah, go ahead and put it back on speaker, and I'll read the rest of it.
Hold on just a moment.
Not a problem.
Okay, we're both here now.
Welcome back, Amelia. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you very much.
Well, I hope your conference call was productive.
It actually was very good. I got to speak to some of the gentlemen from what Alarm and Muster have become in the South. They have a lot of knowledge and established lines and things like that. And I'm talking to them about forming some alliances and about working on the comm section of our workshop for the CECOM meeting. They have long since had established phone lines, you know, the phone tree and things like that. But they're working on a ham radio emphasis. And they're working on repeater locations and things like that. And they actually have a lot of people who are working on this and a lot of really good knowledge. So it was good.
Well, that's good to hear. I when I first started talking to the founder of Alarm and Muster and, you know, the command, you know, some of their state POCs and so forth, you know, if you look at the original statement, the original speech that what is his name? No, I forgot his name. The guy who used to be head of, who was head of it, Tom. I forgot his name. Tom. Anyways, that basically he referenced the committees of correspondence, which were basically the communication line between the committees of safety. Paul Revere, you know, that whole thing. Actually, I believe it was Samuel Adams who created the first committee of correspondence in. 1772, I think. I don't know. I forgot the exact date. But I believe it was Samuel Adams who created the first one. And that's what Alarm and Muster was about. They were trying to reestablish or rebuild that Committee of Correspondence group. And I'm sorry to see that it failed. It fell apart. So.
Well, what I got from them, which, you know, this might be oversimplified, I'm sure it is, but the basis that I got was that centralized national structure was kind of what happened to them. And what they want to do is now, because they've learned from past problems that they've had, they want to focus on regions and focus on communications within regions, but focus on a more localized kind of overview group. And that way they have, you know, they have more local control and they have more local guidance and unity. The impression I got was that when they got to a national kind of overseeing spot, they just kind of lost cohesion on the local levels. So they're fixing that.
Well, you know, are you talking about the group or the group that you were just speaking with? Is that the Southwest region or is that the Southeast region that you were talking to?
Southeast.
You know, some of the guys who are keeping the Southwest, they're keeping their Southwest, they're keeping it now as a Southwest Preparedness, the Southwest Preparedness Project, I believe is what they're calling it?
Preparedness.
They're basically
project,
maintaining the infrastructure, and they're basically calling it the Southwest Preparedness Project now, I believe. That would that would be some of the guys that I know from the old Alarm and Muster group. So, well, I'm glad to hear that was going. So anyways, we're down to our last 11 minutes. And I basically wanted to leave this the end of this discussion up to you guys to talk about the things that we might not have covered yet that, White Owl and myself or you and I didn't cover yet that you feel important and you want to talk about. So you take us where you want to go now.
Well, I of course have 1,000 things that I think are really important to say. I think that what I really want to emphasize is that this meeting in April is going to be the start of a lot of different meetings all around the country, and it is, if we all use it, it will be incredibly successful. And we have lots of tools, like the meeting formats and the workshops and the political lobby and all of the information that different people are donating that are as useful as we make them. And I've been working with a lot of people, and I've had a few different people actually say the exact same phrase to me, that this will work if we make it work. And, you know, that's the idea, is that I've talked to people who say, you know, I've been trying to get a meeting like this together for 20 years, and if you pull this off, it'll be amazing. And, you know, it's absolutely not about me or my group pulling this off. It's about everyone pulling this off, because the people who show up and the people who put the time in are the ones who are going to make this work or not. And, you know, I think that unity is something that is very easy for everybody to sit somewhere and talk about. But when you actually have to get up out of your house, get in the car, and drive for 7 hours to go stand in a field full of people you don't know, and try to develop real bonds with them, I think that's where we see who really cares about unity and who's really going to get up and make this work. You know, in Florida, we've had 2 leadership meetings, and it's brought a lot of people who previously did not speak to each other and did not work with each other in the same room. And when you get off the internet, you know, when you stop sending snide comments to people back and forth and you look at somebody in a room face to face and eye to eye, real meaningful relationships are formed. And all of the other infighting stuff that we see is dispelled a lot. You know, when you look a man in the eye, or a woman, you tend to be more courteous, you tend to be more respectful, and you tend to be more productive. And that's what we need to do. We need to be more productive. We need, you know, the people who say they're dedicated to this movement need to get up every single morning and do everything they can all day long to make this work, because nothing less than that will guarantee our success. You know, we can't be fair-weather patriots. We can't do this on the weekends. We have to make our life and our movements and our actions and our words show what we care about and what we mean.
You know, you're right. And, you know, I've been around for 20-plus years now, and I've seen other people try to, well, like you were saying, you know, people have said, you know, if you could pull this off here, it would be a, you know, damn near a miracle, because I've seen other people try to do many things like this in the past, but it always seems to fall apart because of infighting, different agendas, different ideas, different plans. You know, instead of working on the one plan to restore our Constitution, and the only plan that our founders left us. I mean, there's only one plan they left us. That's it. Unfortunately, it's not on YouTube, so not everybody knows about it.
Well, you need to get it on YouTube.
Yeah, you know, they keep telling me that. They keep telling me I need to get all over YouTube, so maybe one of these days I will. You know, but you're right. You know, our success is going to come from active participation. You know, participation like yours and other people that engage in these things. That's where success is going to be determined. Not online, not by writing letters, but actual physical participation.
Yep. You know, I can buy cases of champagne and get silk curtains and have a band and, you know, lobster tails. And if nobody shows up, it isn't a party. So, you know, this thing takes bodies. It takes peoples. It takes patriots. It takes action and it takes heart. And that's what's going to make it work.
It is. It seems like a lot of your success came beforehand from actually the reason you're having success now is because you were active in the community beforehand in various other projects. You know, maybe not even having to do with patriotism or the Constitution or anything, but you were active in your community on other things. And then when you went and started talking to these people about these things, this militia thing, this constitutional thing, they remembered you from the past. And that opened up a lot of, and that kept those doors open for you then, so people didn't take you as some kind of a crackpot. And that's the thing. We need to be out in our communities again, not presenting ourselves as crackpots, but talking to the people that we know and those that we don't know and talking to them intelligently. Speaking to them, you know, don't talk to them about FEMA death camps, you know, and, you know, I mean, all the other, you know, satanic Luciferian worshiping Masons. But start talking to them about our economy. Our government, is it going the way they want it to be? Let's look at why maybe it's not.
Right. And that's one of the main things that I was, you know, when people say, why did you join a militia? And why do you feel the way you do about our constitutional rights being violated? And, you know, I always say that 4 years ago, I went on a backpacking trip from Mexico to Panama. And I went by myself, and I speak enough Spanish to tell you it's hot in the bathroom and you should be careful. And I went through places like Nicaragua and Honduras and Guatemala, and I saw the horrible things that happen to children and families and people when they do not have a constitution to protect them. And, you know, when you tell people real stories about you and how you came to your realizations, and, you know, you explain your background and you explain why you believe what you believe, it makes a huge impact on people. You know, this whole thing needs to be about human contact. Everything else on the planet that is successful is about human contact. It's about winning the hearts and minds of the people you're talking to. And, you know, everybody is very quick to blame the media for lots of things. But no one wants to use the media to fix those things. And, you know, and that's our greatest tool. You know, we have to take what has been manipulated against us and use it to show us in the light that we are in. You know, and I think that it's just very important that everybody stop going out and, you know, meeting somebody at a party or wherever and starting to rant about conspiracy theories and different stuff and start looking at them and saying, this is how what's going on in our world has affected my family. This is how it could affect yours. This is how I feel about this. You know, if you make a human contact with someone instead of ranting about conspiracy theories, it goes a lot farther.
That's it. You know, I mean, you know, the problem is we present so many ideas out there that really have no basis of any kind or foundation in truth whatsoever, or if they do, it's a minuscule aspect of truth, but we really can't prove anything. We waste our time going after agendas that, even if we got them solved, for instance, you know, if you're working on a project today, ask yourself, if I actually got this whole this little problem here taken care of, would it make my country any more free? If the answer is no, then you're wasting your time. You know, for instance, 9/11. Let's take a look at 9/11. Yes, I think that I don't know the truth of 9/11. I don't know what happened on 9/11. All I know is that I don't know the truth yet. So, but if I do get to the, if we do somehow get to the bottom of 9/11, is that going to free our country and restore our constitutional government?
No.
So maybe we should work on restoring our constitutional government, then we can find out the truth about 9/11.
Right, right. And that's, you know, and that's the mentality that a lot of people get stuck in. They get stuck in, you know, their favorite conspiracy theory and in telling people all about it. And A, they don't understand what a lunatic that makes them look like to most people. And B, they don't understand how unproductive that is. You know, the idea is that we all really need to step back from what we're doing and look at it, like you said, and see if it's going to make a productive difference and if it's really going to make things better. And if it's not, then we need to reevaluate what we're doing and change that. You know, we need to be productive, and we need to be productive in the right areas so that it's meaningful.
Well, that's exactly it. You know, our actions must be meaningful, and if they're not meaningful, if they don't promote and advance our cause, take us to that next step, you know, that's a problem. You know, most of the plans that we see out there, they do not have measurable benchmarks of success. You cannot say, okay, we achieved success here. That means it's time to move on to this phase of the plan. And that's a problem.
Right.
We forgot how to plan. We don't even know how to do a plan anymore. We think that if we write a bunch of demands together, that's a plan. That's not a plan. That's not
right,
a plan
at
all.
We can ignore.
You know, it's plans like that, you know, it's people, you know, and the sad thing is, though, is that we can see that happening today in our country, though, all over. I mean, if you look in business, 95% of all businesses that open up today will be out of business within 5 years. The reason being, that's what their plans look like. A bunch, you know, they put together their plans like all these other plans. It's a bunch of demands or a wish list. No actual plan on how to achieve it.
Right.
You know, that's you know, I think that also comes about, though, because we don't talk to each other, we don't work together towards a common goal. So, you know, I see a lot of the things that you're doing out there working towards that common goal, you know, and trying to get people to start thinking about some different, you know, thinking about things a different way. I think you bring a much refreshing aspect of PR to us instead of, you know, the typical guy in a camel with his gun slung around his neck and talking to the camera. Don't have a problem with that, but it's not going to reach mainstream. It's not going to reach the mainstream, you know, Joes out there.
Right, and even, you know, even in our group, I started thinking about trying to take a more of a PR role, just because of, you know, we have lots of guys who are really committed to this, and their wives don't get it, you know, and their kids don't get it, and it's because they can't relate to the people who he's out there doing this with. But, you know, if you've got somebody like me in the field who calls up somebody's wife and says, hey, he told me you like camp. Will you come out and hang out with him? Will you, you know, spend some time in an FCS? Will you help us in Sierra camp and, you know, help us with meals and things like that? You know, even just in your individual group, much less on a larger PR scale, it helps a lot to have lots of different kinds of people who are very active because they can bring people in who normally wouldn't feel comfortable and normally wouldn't feel like they had anything in common with the people in your group. You know, I think that that's a really important thing. And, you know, my next thing is I'm terrified of the camera, although I'm getting over that on TV. And my next thing is to make some YouTube videos that talk about militia. And, you know, show a different face. And I guess, you know, if I could make YouTube videos, you probably could, too. Maybe we could do this together.
Hey, there you go. We could do some videos or something. I'm telling you, though, I'm not photogenic at all. I'm, you know, one of those 250-pound guys with a shaved head and a goatee that kind of scares people as they cross and make people cross the street. But we'll do what we got to do.
Absolutely.
I'm not joking. I'm serious. I was in a very expensive Italian suit walking down downtown Seattle. I'm one of the top advertising execs in the country. And I had a lady literally look at me and cross the street as I was walking towards her, middle of the day. She stopped, looked at me, and crossed the street. You know, it hustled across the street. So, you know, I'm not one of those pretty guys that belongs on camera, but we'll do what we can. So we'll talk about that. Well, listen, we are past our time. We are past the 2-hour mark. And I want to get back to my life and my family over and my father-in-law that's here. And I know you guys I know it's getting late there on the East Coast. So White Owl, Amelia. By the way, White Owl, what is your real name? It was Darren, isn't it? Or Daryl or
Darren.
Darren
Wilburn.
Darren Wilburn. Okay, I'm sorry about it. Bad with names. Terrible with names, faces I never forget. I really want to thank you both for coming on and spending this last 2 hours with us. I enjoyed it. I think it was informative. I think that the things that you guys are engaging upon are productive and beneficial. You know, I encourage people to take a look at them, you know, and get involved. I know that Equalizer already is, and I know a few other people that I've talked to down in the Southeast that even if they can't get down there, they look at participating in the future.
Randy, thank you very much for the kind words, and I want to personally thank you for your efforts in enlightening and trying to advance what we all hold very dear.
We each have our role to play. We each have our role to play. You know, I do what I got to do. I'm doing what I do, and hopefully, if everybody out there does the things that they need to do, you know, maybe one day we'll actually find ourselves free again in the country that our fathers conquered for us. So with that being said, everybody, I want to thank, you know, you guys. Keep me informed. Let me know how this is going. I would love to talk to you guys also after the CCOM meeting. I would love to get you guys back on, talk to you about that, find out how it went. Find out what went well, what didn't go so well, areas you guys can improve upon. So if you guys are open to that, let me know. I would love to get you guys back on and talk about that again.
And I will be in touch with you in the next couple of days. I'm going to send you an email picking your brain about committees of safety and how to conduct that workshop and who to call and get help with that.
Not a problem. So, I'll be more than happy to help you out there. So hit me up. And Darren, I got your phone number. I'll give you a call here in the next day or two as well, okay?
Sounds very good.
All right, you guys take care. Everybody else, thank you for listening in. That was this week's edition or this Sunday's edition of You Have Tried Me Radio. Tomorrow we are going to have on Gary Hunn. We are going to be discussing, we're going to actually be calling it the end of the revolution, beginning of independence. We're going to be looking at some of these concepts that are those things that are tying us down, keeping us enslaved. And one of the first questions we're going to ask are the cops constitutional? Gary feels that we're going to be discussing that. Is this police force that we have, these cops that we have, that internal militarized body that our founding fathers warned us of? We're also going to be looking at the Supreme Court case of John Bad Elk. If you don't know who that is, this gentleman shot the sheriff, and he did not go to jail for it. Well, he went to jail at first, but the Supreme Court ruled that he was completely innocent because the sheriff was engaging in an unlawful arrest. The sheriff, or I don't know if he was a sheriff, but the cop died. John Baddock was set free. So we'll be discussing that as well. With that being said, and then again, we have Fox on this upcoming Saturday again as well. So with that being said, if you guys have any questions, feel free to email me, randymack@youhavetreadonme.com. Any questions, any ideas, any suggestions, you want to tell me that I'm full of shit, you let me know. Get in touch with me. I answer all emails. If you guys have any questions, I'm always available to talk one-on-one if you want or with groups. So until then, we'll see you guys tomorrow on Tread Me Radio. Take care. Bye-bye.